Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you sitting in with us, wherever you happen to be on this blue pearl that floats around in the big universe. I'm broadcasting this from Canada, and I'd like to pay homage to somebody significant to my country, to my nation, and to other nations around the world who has finished her time on this earth with us after 96 years. Now, I'm speaking of Elizabeth, the Queen of Scotland. I won't be maudlin about it. I've had the pleasure of meeting some very brave men and women who have fought for our country, and fought for Queen and country, and have brought honors to themselves and through their sacrifice to the likes of you and from me and my family. We're grateful. And I know it would be simplistic to think that all things about a constitutional monarchy are simple or pure or happiness, but that's not the case. We're going to be burying this woman tomorrow, and this is no time to dissect or shred the life of somebody that has had such a high profile. No time, and I'm not sure there ever would be a proper time for that. We'll leave that for the historians. What I can say is that I have a sense of mourning, a personal mourning, a loss. I'm not like you, I don't have a vault full of symbols of integrity and duty and sacrifice. I don't. Mine is very meager. Some of the categories of values seem almost like there's nobody there some days. But this frail woman, this one person, represented so much. And it did it with a dignity that is, I believe, inspiring to anybody, whether they're an ally or an enemy. We understand truth to power, and she certainly did. She let us know that by her own example, that there was a way of conducting a life and influencing one another with dignity, with respect. And so to Elizabeth, the world is a better place because she was born, because you were born. You left a world behind with so many people who admire. To the people who grieve England and Britain represented to their culture, I have the sense that they will find it in their hearts to be very forgiving of you. Not the issues, not the politics. No, of course not. But you were beyond. She couldn't stop necessarily the hatred of men, but she could make it very clear that that was not the way to progress. Hatred doesn't really get us anywhere. And so with my little cup of espresso here this morning, I'll be repeatedly toasting. And I'd like to dedicate this silly little show to a silly little program by a silly little man to the memory of a very, very noble human being who will be tremendously missed. And when I'm in an hour where I need a bit of inspiration and things are strained, when that happens, I hope that I will be able to call up the memory of this woman. So that's the sound of a person who isn't a monarchist and not a subject, feeling the loss of his queen. Oh dear. I'm not the only one that carries on like that, I know. We replace that darkness in the abyss. You know, we look into it periodically. We all do. And we replace that with a knowledge that the bleakness, the darkness, contains something, that we our weapon against that is understanding and knowledge, or knowledge and understanding. It may be there's some ugliness there before us. There may be some calamity, but we don't need to bend our knee to it. And while somebody may be running away or shrieking or complaining that the world is terribly unfair, you know, we do. this is the crowd that doesn't really register whether things are fair or not. It is what it is. There's information to be had and decisions to be made. And we happen to be part of a group that, what would you say? We demonstrate goodwill wherever we can. Yeah, I think so. There's times when our lodges are locked in discussions about attitudes toward one another, attitudes toward the craft, how to build, how to proceed. Some will let themselves feel overwhelmed. You have to say it that way. Let themselves feel overwhelmed. Others will always find a way of refocusing. You know, to expect that the craft would do that? No. You live your own life, you know. But you're around. Once you begin doing that, refocusing, it doesn't become so tedious, and you begin to wonder, I think, speaking for myself, why more people don't learn how. And I know. I live in a world where I live in remarkable privilege, and I know that the narrative around me ignores the families that go to bed at night hungry, and that don't have stable housing and aren't really sure where they're going to be tomorrow. And I live in a place where men continue to beat up their wives and children, and still laugh about it, mock it. I don't ever stop struggling to correct that problem in every way that I can. But when you start to do this, you know, you start to think a life of truth. You start to live a life with that kind of a challenge. Like, it's easy enough just to pretend we're all just dogs and we're all just cheats, that we'll get away with whatever we can when we can, because we're inherently loathsome, that the truth be known, we're unworthy creatures, that we're untrustworthy. And then that we need enforcers to ensure that we walk the line. look what pulp literature has done to the attitudes, and the majority of people are decent folks worldwide. They're trying to get by the same way you and I do, the best way that we can. Oh, we can be hurt and lied to and manipulated, especially when we're trusting. What would life be like if we walked around with our guard up, mistrusting every soul that came near us? Well, I can tell you that life would be very isolating. It's very lonely. You think about it. And it takes the spark out of life, looking at the world with suspicion. But when there's something much more meaningful going on. But in the meantime, those folks exist, whether they recite scripture, or they'll have some form of slogan, or often a very glib a way of speaking about others. And there's these days with social media, there's lots of dog whistles out there, you know, that seem to sound off more strongly with one group of people than others. But I've often wondered, and help me with this. I've often wanted to scratch my head. A very lovely person just the other day was talking to me about getting up in the morning and looking at the news, and you read some papers, and a lot of it is about conflict, and rightfully so, a lot of it is about conflict, and it leaves the impression that that's the way that men are. We're constantly at each other's throats. But that's not the truth. That's an impression, but it's not the truth. If we're looking for truth in terms of understanding the all, the one, there are conflicts. There are manipulators and people that will seed conflict for their own gain. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but they do exist. They don't do well in public when we expose them. They don't do it all well. They don't like that. They like to operate in the shadows. But there's so much. If our media was tuned to creating a more realistic impression, more realistic reflection of what's going on around us, what do you think it would be like when we turned on the news, the broadcast, or picked up a newspaper, or read an article in social media? What do you think it would be like? Do you think it's possible? And I do, to use these tools as a platform for general education and development of a sense of nationality and state purpose and harmony. How could we do that? I'd like to think it's possible, but my gosh, with so much cynicism around, how would we do that without that becoming despotism, that are becoming sort of an ideology, big political movements? We have politicians around me that aren't really processing situations. They're issuing forth according to an old ideology. Less is better, and everybody fends for themselves, except the rich who need our protection to do that. That's not entirely to say that everybody's to blame for everything. Everybody gets by the best way they can. But is there a reckoning on this? Yeah, there is. There is. And does that give us any moral authority? I don't know exactly. No, I think the truth does, and I think the people that talk about a life following that kind of, you imagine how challenging that is to be rooting. Here he is. He's coming again. That bloody epistemologist. He wants to know the source of everything. Wants to know where the idea came from and how long it's been with us and whether it's been modified over the centuries. What a nuisance. We can just avoid him. And because we want to avoid him, because, my gosh, he's engaging. We'll want to talk with him. We'll have questions. We'll have our own ideas. And he'll be sitting there listening. Who wants that? Here, the answer to who wants that is all of you sitting in today. Lovely to have you with us. Let's get on with a bit of music. The commentary today, Solitudes, I think it's, everything about Masonic Effects is derivative, including me, my gosh, especially me. But it seems to entertain and inform, at least that's what your listeners have been telling me. So sit back and enjoy. Have some good music. The poet, I don't think in all the years, we're in all 10 years, I don't think we've had Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I don't think we've showcased that. I don't think. Well, we are today. We're looking at his work, A Psalm of Life. It's an awkward tribute to the Queen, and I hope you'll like it. But we begin with some absolutely gorgeous music. This is a man that many of you may not have ever heard of, Liacono, and his trio. This is the Waltz for My Hero. It's just pretty amazing. Thank you. For those of you who have a streaming service, look up Mariano Loicano. Waltz from My Hero. Beautiful music. So I start with a small narrative about a woman that is what what she said. Without ever saying it, this truly is a person that never didn't court applause, and she is loved by all high-minded men and respected by her superiors. Lovely person. We're talking about authenticity again. There you go. Solitudes. Okay. I struggle over the titles for these commentaries. You know? Here, see what you think. Help me with this one, because I was struggling all through it. I think it's kind of evident. The mind may stand alert at the prospect, but it comes at a price. Understanding the reality of existence is going to take us into some undesirable experiences. See distress for which there is no simple answers. They too are real. It is an interesting exercise to break down complex questions into components that are simpler to resolve. Then, with the accumulated findings, reconstruct assertions that may or may not be precise. In the big picture, there we allow for this in our science. what we declare today is subject to emerging facts that were not available then. By examining history, we can track stages in the development of thought and science around the world over the eons and compare, juxtapose a man into that configuration. And we have reason, active minds find the challenge irresistible. Should that man lack ethical standards at the start, he will unavoidably grapple with them before he finishes. Freemasonry talks to us about repositioning. It takes our perspective beyond ego to as far as the imagination will take us, and then some. How a man plants his feet on the ground matters less than accomplishing it while being true to the exquisitely crafted values and principles that's revealed in our language of symbols, there for all to find. Notice how different the manner and attitude of others. Notice their literacy isn't the same. That might be noticed that knowledge is within itself a type of solitude. And if it is, enrich it. What are you reading? What music inspires? Do poets and painters and sculptors speak to you in your private reverie? Masonry will start a man on a search for meaning, but what he does with that search has everything to do with tenacity and imagination. Of all the people who have studied Freemasonry, what or who is telling you you are deserving of its lessons? Is it a difficult past, social awkwardness, limits? No matter. A life to explore with a bag full of landmarks to guide us. Maybe that's what we're doing, is winnowing out the crowd because it's so hard. Who wants to be patient? Who wants to dedicate themselves to learning? Maybe this is your form of learning. Perhaps it was a sport. Perhaps it was fly fishing. Perhaps it was learning to collect firewood and prepare, have enough water on hand for the family. Perhaps it was music, an instrument, or a science, or mathematics, or theory. Maybe you needed to know how these big systems around us interact and why, what motivates, what causes, Or the grand, these vast narratives that we employ. Our politics is a big narrative. Whatever, we move forward constantly with this sense that we must stop and talk about that someday. Time, space. I did that before, maybe 5 years ago. We did that on Masonic effects, but maybe it's time we pick that up again. After all, there's been a bit of progress, don't you think? Booker Irvin's Quintet's going to tell us all about that progress. This is a beautiful standard. You don't know what love is. Yeah, that's true. His work, my goodness. Booker Irvin Quintet, You Don't Know What Love Is. Do yourself a favor, that's a good one. That's gentle on the mind, that is. Have you begun to bend over the odd time or lean in a little closer to look at the detail of what's happening around you? If you have, I'm chuffed. And if you're a regular listener, you tune into Masonic Effects. I'm going to take full credit for that and all other things that you've mastered. And the unanswerables that you've conquered. I want to take credit. You need to take credit for something, even as absurd as that. Eh? You've leaned into detail. I'm fascinated by the courage that it takes. You know, it's like when I think about some performers, some singers. You're out there. You have the orchestra wrapped around you, but it's the instruments, the voice, right? And there's nothing between you and the audience. You know, it's just this beautiful resonance, this vibration through the ether. And I think that takes can you imagine what tension would do, any kind of tension would do? Well, a bit will inspire us, won't it? It's exciting, you know, you're sharp. Like, let's do this. And you're alive. And we know that when we have cortisol and adrenaline surging through us, our senses are keener. Our hearing, our smell, our sight, everything's clearer. Thank you. It's one of those complexities about us. It's there. Think of the courage, and for somebody to not succumb to peer pressure. I say that from the sense that peer pressure, where I throughout my life and what I've seen around, is bullying. You know, it's the awkwardness. We want the people to be back in line. It's an effort at controlled or sustainable mediocrity, because stepping up means somebody else might feel inadequate, and we couldn't possibly do that unless you're around a theater group or performing arts or you're in a laboratory or a classroom where we're trying to excite the mind of others. With no possibility of telling them how far that will go, no possibility at all. Knowing that they will learn the same science that we know, and only they will put it together differently. It's like if you do play chess, I hope so. I always had in my office. I always had a chess game going on. My ongoing chess games with myself. For a while, it was with a friend who's some hours away from me. It was delightful, but other than that, it would be a game I would be playing with myself. It would take weeks and months, you know, just when you're on the telephone and you're thinking. Just look at the board and decide on a move. But it was what it was doing to my mind. I always hope that I'm always such a fan. I'm terrible, a big fan of chess players, competitive chess players. I just think this is wonderful. The detail to be able to do that, and then the courage to share. The courage to share the moves, to share the artistry, the motion. You know, we have a fellow that looks at these fields of daffodils, and what he sees, this motion and harmonies, he sees rhythms in it. Silly man. Today I'm talking to our guest, a poet today, is of course Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. He is American. In the best tradition of America, I must say, please don't judge all America by what's been happening in the last couple of years. There was a nobleness to it. I know. I'm going to be looking at how do I justify that when there was genocide undergo? I don't. Yeah, I've justified that, but that's another comment. It was wrong. Henry was born in 1807 in Portland, Massachusetts, and he came from a privileged background. He attended private schools, and he graduated from a place called Bowdoin College in 1825. And there, one of the reasons that, you know, I turned toward him, he was reading Sir Walter Scott's work and Washington Irving's work. And so, you know, let's presume that that was a sign that he was literate. He was so fluent in translating that on graduation he was offered a professorship in modern languages, provided that he would first study in Europe. Oh, forced me to go to Europe to study. Oh, and he learned French and Spanish and Italian, but he didn't really get into the regime, the regimen of scholarship. So in 1829, he returned to the United States to be a professor and librarian at Bowdoin. And he wrote and edited textbooks, and he translated poetry and wrote essays in French and Spanish and Italian literature. But he wasn't feeling really connected with it. And then he was offered a professorship at Harvard with an opportunity to go abroad again, and he accepted. And he went to Germany in 1835. And there on this trip, he visited England and Sweden and the Netherlands. Think about the expansion of his thinking, just that alone. An academic going into these intellectually enriched cultures. Yeah, he had some setbacks. He was married in 1831, and his first wife died in 1835. And then he fell under the influence of German Romanticism. Yes. This is the guy that wrote the Song of Hiawatha and Paul Revere's Ride. And, you know, he wrote about he had anti-slavery sentiments. He wasn't quite Whittier's, you know, it wasn't John or Greenleaf Whittier's power voice, but he was more at home in Evangeline and in a narrative poetry poem format that he got into almost every literate home in the country. That's influence, yeah? And it's a tale of two lovers separated when British soldiers expel the Acadians from what is now Nova Scotia. And the lovers, Evangeline and Gabriel, are reunited years later as Gabriel is dying. We'll do that poem later. Today, we're going to look at this incredible piece of work, A Psalm of Life. And it is a reflection here. And it is inspired by Elizabeth Banks. And this was first published in 1838. So just imagine that people in Britain, literate people, would be picking up this up and reading it. And it was first published by the coincidentally in the Knickerbocker magazine. It was a monthly. It came out in New York City. So it later became known as the New York Monthly. And this psalm, you know, psalms, it's a didactic tone to it. You know, you're going to expand on an idea. And the poem begins with a verb, which is kind of, you know, it's like that first chord in Hard Day's Night by the Beatles, you know, boom. And then the second stanza begins with the line, life is real. Here, let me show you. Tell me not in mournful numbers, life is but an empty dream. But the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Thou art to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end of way, but to act with each tomorrow, find us farther than today. Art as long and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not the dumb driven cattle, be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act in the living present, heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints in the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother seeing, shall take heart again. Then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving and pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. Come back this morning, this afternoon, this evening. Pull up a chair. We'll listen to Paul Desmond all the rest of the night away. It's beautiful, beautiful. What would you say if I began today introducing or talking about a ritual in 1757? Would you be okay with that? Not anything that would matter in the big scheme of things, but deducing, taking meaning from it. Now, I would consider that you have your own experience with this, so all of this is leveraged on your experience, and that's not, it's a kind of experience. It doesn't come with a little caveat. Oh, here's, a whispering in your ear. Here's everything you need to know about this experience. We don't have that. That's the area for, that's room for Masonic effects and the likes of you men and women. Here, I'm picking this up in Amsterdam in 1757. And in a ritual recorded, the candidate for the degree of entered apprentice is asked, in what place was the first lodge formed? And the answer followed, it's a catechism, okay? Upon a mountain inaccessible to the profane, where a cock was never heard to crow, a lion to roar, or a woman to babble. Otherwise, no, don't give me, don't judge me, I'm just... Otherwise, in a deep valley, in the case of women, the prohibition against entrance extended to them as a species, to the whole gender. One of the first printed defenses of that policy explained that the essence of a society of women could never be that of men. How wrong they were. We can never have a role in true governance. They can. They can never have a role. Special circumstances, it would seem, had to be present before they could be permitted passage to the light of Freemasonry. Nah. So we make the declarations. They're inferior. They're not, they are. With some specious kind of argument that borders on the incredible. It might be presumed that where the fraternity felt less threatened, its understanding of the profane might become more malleable. Now think about that. We know that the United Grand Lodge in England is doing things with women Freemasonry that other Grand Lodges can't even conceive of. And yes, it has to do with the confidence. These Grand Lodges operate like our lodges are like us. We operate when there's confidence and we can tackle the uncomfortable. Some of these topics pinch our shoes, pinch our feet. And yet they deal with them. They deal with them. They're able to bring it up and they're able to talk about it where other culture, other lodges can't. That's an indicator that there needs to be conversation. However, this was never the case, It might be presumed that where the fraternity felt less threatened, its understanding of the profane might be more malleable. However, this has never been the case. In Britain, the prohibition against women in the lodges remained throughout the 18th century, despite occasional calls for a reform. It remains to this day. The 18th century, the explanation for its rigidity might rest on the weight of guild tradition. Despite the fact that women in earlier times had been known to break through that tradition, at least in England, if not in Scotland, and to be admitted to the guilds, it was in the Continental Lodges that the exclusion of women broke down. The lodges for women and men came into existence by the second half of the 18th century, and we may legitimately ask about the circumstances of that reform. Have we already become immediately judgmental? Well, that's very profane of us, isn't it? You know, drag the profane world into our conversation. The Continental Freemasonry was wrong, and the City of London was right. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Would you care to give some evidence to that effect? What we find is that the acceptance of women into the fraternity required a particular set of circumstances which had less to do with the social rank of either the men or the women than it did with the economic situation of the women themselves, as well as their willingness to embrace the Masonic vision of enlightened culture. In addition, the evidence strongly suggests that the lodges for men and women laid emphasis on only certain aspects of Masonic idealism, upon virtue in the polity, and in this is distinct from its governance. That's important. It is a distinction. The absence of language of governance within the proceedings of the women's lodges only reinforces the point that first and foremost, the male lodges were schools of government. Of course there's more. Of course there's more. Are we back to that tedious battle of the sexes again? Oh my, you know, tire of it. It's like, why? Can't we, you know, if we're enlightened men, can we not possibly make any kind of intellectual excursion that recognizes the mind is, and us, contains elements of both genders? Is there no Kabbalists out there? You know, help me here. Help me, you know, help me, you know. Are we all caught up in some retro fantasy about, you know, some superstition about, you know, our position because somebody wrote it down, that wrote women out of history? Come. Are we that limited, you know? Are we? Then, you know, help me. Where's that? Isn't there something about a Polish woman and two Nobel Prizes and, you know, what's her name? Curie? Is that? Yeah. Get it right, eh? Get it right. We've got work to do. Enlighten people. Oh, I don't want to see or encourage anything that might not be gender specific because, well, the answer to that for me, I have no idea where you're going with that. Fitting. I'm where it's raining right now. Fitting. So I thought a little Stan Getz, Misty, might be, yeah. Help us out here. Help us out. Don't Don't you just love it when things fall together? Thanks for sitting in, of course. It's a pleasure to have you here. It makes this all worthwhile for all of us around. I look forward to seeing you again. A little bit entertaining, a little bit informative, but look at us. We sit back, we indulge the sensibilities, we listen to, we actually pay attention to poetry. What's that saying about us? And we're enjoying something. We're enjoying something together. If we could only do this in our lodges. And I know you fellas that are listening from locations, and you just don't have access. Well, because of infirmity or whatever, maybe you're traveling. Well, that's all right. Here's a voice in the wilderness then. I'm sure that if we listen to somebody who's monitoring the universe a few light years away, they're picking up the sounds that are out there. Won't that be a gas if they could just, somebody's monitoring, picks this up in their classroom a million light years away, and it talks about 2022 and the sonic effects. Wouldn't that be a trip? Anyway, I hope you'll commit acts of random Masonic kindness. I think there's room in the world for a few of those. And include yourself. If you're going to be an upright Mason, treat yourself with the dignity that deserves. No, I'm not talking about the arrogance or pretentiousness. No. Far from it. That's embarrassing. But realize that this is your commitment to you. And if you haven't, then simply you need to, I think, ask the question, am I worth it? Because this is work. It is. Nobody makes us do this. Nobody cajoles us. Guilt, although my Grand Lodge is quite good at trying that. I think it's become quite toothless now. But settle in. I think you'll find that there are reasons to pursue the learnings. But your direction, please get on with it, because you have a world out there that's waiting to see what you discover. Bless you all. Take care, and long live the Queen. And long live the King. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.